the last week of June, we got a chance to sing one of my favorite hymns, and it hasn't been sung since then, except that last night Lindy had some trouble working with it on the recorder. I'd like to have the opportunity to sing this hymn once more before our family goes back to Minnesota. Hymn number 17, the first two.
Honor, glory, and dominion.
You all know the story about the rich young ruler who came to Christ and asked what he should do to enter, to become a member of heaven. And Christ told him to sell all that he had and give it to the poor. And this was very depressing for this rich young ruler. Let's suppose that there's some kind of rich young ruler here at Holden. We could imagine some very handsome, tall kind of person who has an awful lot going for himself. He came here from college with a Phi Beta Kappa key and probably a very fat Danforth scholarship to join the Maverick crew. And there was something very commanding about this person. He went to Henning Falkenstein's discussion on Kafka, and everybody was bewildered about Kafka, and this rich young ruler stood up and with a few simple, clear words sort of explained away the whole mystery of Kafka and ruined Henning's discussion. This rich young ruler, this maverick member of the staff, there's something about him that just makes him a natural leader of the group. In any kind of discussion, in any kind of picnic, any kind of hike, he's always out there in front. And whatever he says seems to happen, or seems to go. This rich young ruler here at Holden has the kind of sensitivity of a night owl or a bat. In the dark, in the middle of the night, he always knows where the action is. This fellow lives high up here in the valley in the grandest kind of manner. And in all dimensions, he seems to be perfectly at ease with his world and with his fellow beings. There's nothing that he lacks and nothing that he wants. At least so it seems. This very sensitive bat with this radar who knows where the action is sensed that one day the action was down at Chelan, or maybe even farther down at Wenatchee. And he heard that the man Jesus was there. Now it's kind of strange that this tall, handsome, perfect kind of person would in any way be attracted to Jesus, because Jesus was one of the most innocuous, despised, and ugly people of the whole history of man. And how could this fellow be attracted to this rejected person? But he sensed somehow that Jesus had a tremendous following, and he just had to go down and find out what this was all about. He left the valley and went down to Wenatchee, and he was very sincere in this move. He really did consider the possibility of affiliating with Jesus' movement, and maybe he could even come back and lead his peers towards making some sort of decision to affiliate also with this movement. He brought his dossier with him. He always carried that around. It had his college record. He was an Eagle Scout, president of the camera club. He brought his grade point ratio and all these kinds of things. And he presented this dossier to Jesus. Jesus was terribly excited about what he saw. These credentials were perfect. But as Jesus examined this candidate, he said, "Alas, you will not fit." The fact that our rich young ruler had so much going for him was an obstacle. The other members of the group, these disciples or these followers, couldn't accept our rich young ruler because they had nothing going for themselves. Their bodies showed the effects of their disinheritance. They were displaced persons. And all over their bodies, there was evidence of some kind of prolonged hacking and gnawing as a response to their life situation. These were very humble men who had absolutely nothing going for themselves, but they did have an aristocratic stance that they had won for themselves. This rich young ruler, the maverick on the staff, was an aristocrat by birth, and his aristocracy was only a kind of cosmetic. And so Jesus told him that he had to renounce everything before he could affiliate with the movement. Now, I don't know what that means for our friends. It's a problem that I struggle with for myself. But at the risk of being too corny and obvious, I might suggest that he'd have to melt down his Phi Beta Kappa key and maybe burn up his diploma or his confirmation certificate. At any rate, he'd have to get rid of this dossier that shows that he had fulfilled all of the requirements leading to a degree, including this confirmation certificate. And he had to have a kind of clean slate and start over again. It's also very possible that this rich young man, after his Holden Village summer, was planning to go to graduate school to do professional work. And maybe he would have to give up this plan. It's really very possible that he wasn't committed to this profession. Maybe it's dentistry. He was only in it because it was a sure thing, and he didn't have to worry about it. I think he's sort of like Richard Cory, if you know the poem by Edward Arlington Robinson, and I can't quote the whole poem, but maybe some of you know about Richard Cory, this very handsome man. When he walked down the street, all the ladies' pulses fluttered as he talked and walked. Well, our rich young man was like Richard Cory, but he was different after that trip down to Wenatchee. He had been tested and he failed. He became a very hostile and defensive person after that. For a while, he belonged to the local ad hoc committee to repeal the 20th century. Then he tried the Sierra Club. And finally, he just tried to be a good maverick. But the long, hot summers that followed that experience were filled with kind of apathy and indifference. And one night when he read in the Chicago paper that Jesus had taken a fatal double-barrel shotgun blast in the back, he went home and put a bullet through his head. He was richly endowed and perfect, but he didn't know how to get his feet wet. Now let's leave him for a moment and talk about another perfect kind of object, a richly endowed, carefully made object that also was often denied the possibility of getting wet. I'd like to talk about the American Hobie surfboard. And this had something to do with something. There is in the United States a disdain for our life and times, reflected first in a healthy preoccupation with things uneconomic, and second, as demonstrated by this surfboard, in a respect for an art and pursuit which are clearly disdainful of this life and of these times. And the design and production of surfboards is a very subtle pursuit. Each board is tailor-made for its clients, and it becomes an extension of the physiology, the skill, the limitations, and the potentials of the user, and even his temperament. And it's designed for him alone by a craftsman whose skills include sloyd and mathematics and a grasp of contemporary materials and techniques. Like skiing, surfing is a contest, not with others, but with nature, except that surfing raises the odds, for the surfer personally challenges the moving sea rather than the static mountain slope. But, unfortunately, the surfboard becomes an emblem of an atavistic and beautiful folly, and like powered lawnmowers, it exists in greater numbers than do its users. It is for many a symbol of escape, disdain, and lonely power, but it rests emblematically against many a back garage wall. There's something about our country that puts a great deal of energy into producing these kinds of products, and the product becomes a kind of substitute for reality. In Minnesota, there are more after the ski outfits are sold to people who don't even know what a ski looks like than our skis. Let's talk about bathing suits. Maybe this isn't very appropriate at Holden, but I know at home there are thousands of bathing suits that are condemned to sit next to hot, greasy skin, all soaked up with suntan lotion, and they never get a chance to get wet. They never get a chance to go into the water. When I'm sitting on the hot sauna bench, I too hate that plunge, the terror of that cold water. And I guess I'd rather let my bathing suit just get hot and sweaty and let it go at that. Well, this had something to do with our rich young ruler. He somehow couldn't figure out how to let himself go, how to get his feet wet, what it meant to deny himself. And as I've already suggested, this is a terribly personal kind of problem. There is a real terror in letting go, in affiliating with any kind of movement or any kind of position. There's a real terror connected with any kind of deep caring or loving. And when one puts one's whole being at the disposal of something beyond himself, whether it's cold water or a person or a movement or an idea, this is a terrifying situation. No one who has ever deeply loved another human being or chosen a vocation or a social cause or a religious faith has ever escaped this kind of terror. A lot of the following statements are formula that we carry with us in our Christian heritage. Be not anxious for the morrow will be anxious for itself. Or he who would be my disciple must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. These are very easy things to say, but I think very difficult to understand. Or whoever does not carry his cross and come after me cannot be a disciple of mine. These are a lot of the themes that are woven into a book like The Cost of Discipleship by Bonhoeffer. And what motivates this discussion of the rich young ruler tonight is not necessarily the kind of denial that Bonhoeffer's death bears testimony to. In the broadest sense of the word, he becomes a graphic example of what we're trying to get at. But I'm motivated more by microscopic, mundane, and picayune matters that have to do with a second-by-second passage of time in our life here and now. It's very possible that some of us in this room will become Bonhoeffers. Or I think of my classmate at St. Olaf, Jim Reeb, who died at Selma. Or men like Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, who ended up in a dike down in Mississippi. Or maybe the three astronauts who died, who gave up their lives, and probably improved the safety of our moonshot. Some of us maybe will play these roles, but most of us will do less spectacular things. We'll go home and raise soybeans or breed better Holstein cattle or teach third grade or make a nice home. Maybe we'll be doctors. Maybe we're doctors, lawyers. Maybe we're beggarmen. Maybe there are a few thieves among us. And even for the thief, all of these things are still pertinent. No one denies himself unless, out of loyalty to Jesus, he accepts death in advance, even the most ignominious death. And at night we sleep, and it ought to be quite literally a sleep of death, the death of an old day. Tomorrow is a new day which has never been before, and it will never be again. And so I'm talking about these ideas in terms of pulling out yesterday's solutions to today's problems, just because it's a sure thing. It worked yesterday, so why won't it work today? I'm sort of thinking of the mood of playing chicken on the freeway wearing a pair of rusty skates, or going fishing for brook trout with a very fragile little thin thread, or maybe jumping off a buckskin mountain like Icarus with some wings that Tweet provides made out of feathers and paraffin. Bonhoeffer says that the cross means sharing the suffering of Christ to the last and to the fullest. The cross is there, you only have to pick it up. Every Christian has his own cross waiting for him, a cross destined and appointed by God. And I've talked to a lot of people around here, and I think I know what their cross is. And a lot of people that I've talked to know what all of these statements mean about denying oneself or dying or picking up his cross. At this particular moment, all I can say is that by the cross, I mean my duty, my job, my reason for being, or my destiny. I mean by self-denial, the rejection of all my success. My successes are questions which demand new answers. Self-denial implies the will to mature. It suggests the horror of middle age at 21 years. It's a rejection of the idolatry of the security of the now. And I think it's this kind of idolatry that became the box that kept our rich young ruler from moving ahead and from being able to affiliate with Christ's movement. I know how to talk about this in terms of art, in terms of painting and sculpture, and maybe this will help in this explanation. When you look at a work of art, I think what you're really responding to is the adeptness of the artist's mind and his ability to devour problems of art. And it's this evidence that confers value on a particular painting or a sculpture. It doesn't matter what the artist starts with, what mode he begins with. He might start with a nude, with a series of colored squares, with a big smear of black paint, with the letter D, with the word eat or die. It doesn't matter where he begins. All beginnings are cliches. And for art, the repertoire of modern art was clearly established by about 1914, and nothing much has changed since then. But it's finding this obstacle to going ahead that becomes the problem, and that's what counts. It's the discovery and starting point of some kind of metamorphosis. And involved in this is some kind of prolonged hacking and gnawing. This is a kind of engagement, and a work is created through this kind of engagement. And apart from that kind of hacking and gnawing, every kind of excellence can be copied. I like the words hacking and gnawing better than the words creativity. I think creativity is this. It's just hard work. It is hacking and gnawing. And these followers of Jesus had this kind of mark upon their bodies. Well, our rich young friend began with cliches, as we all do. He learned Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. He learned all of these kinds of things. And his models were of the highest order of excellence. But somehow he couldn't go ahead. And he committed this unpardonable sin of just repeating himself. And he really consumed himself rather than added to himself. He repeated what had been given to him at birth, and he was incapable of hacking and gnawing and of adding to the creation. And I think if there's anything that comes out of this Holden experience, it will be realized for my family in the immediate future as we confront new kinds of problems, because I've seen people that really know how to hack and gnaw, and there's a kind of courage here, a way of letting oneself go, a way of opening oneself up. And I think, I'm quite sure that in the future there will be brand new solutions, brand new ways of coming to grips with the second-by-second existence of my life. I should say that one could talk on for hours about the Holden experience. I think the best way to say it is that for my family, this has been a very happy time. But let me conclude this by reading a statement that I think says what I'm trying to say. Bonhoeffer quotes Luther in the sermon, Discipleship and the Cross. Discipleship is not limited to what you can comprehend. It must transcend all comprehension. Plunge into the deep waters beyond your own comprehension, and I will help you to comprehend even as I do. Bewilderment is the true comprehension. Not to know where you are going is the true knowledge. My comprehension transcends yours. Thus Abraham went forth from his father, and not knowing whither he went, he trusted himself to my knowledge and cared not for his own. And thus he took the right road and came to his journey's end. Behold, that is the way of the cross. You cannot find it yourself, so you must let me lead you as though you were a blind man. Wherefore it is not you, no man, no living creature, but I myself who instruct you by my word and spirit in the way you should go. Not the work which you choose, not the suffering you devise, but the road which is clean, contrary to all that you choose or contrive or desire. That is the road you must take. To that I call you, and in that you must be my disciple. If you do that, there is the acceptable time, and there your master is come. Could we conclude our service, which hasn't come up with any answers, has only indicated a few possible ways of thinking about this problem of denial. Could we conclude this by singing 547? Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide.